I vow to face the truth of the Tathagata's words. Welcome. And a happy Mahaprajapati Memorial Day. This morning we celebrated the yearly memorial ceremony for Acharya Mahaprajapati, our first woman ancestor in India. And her picture is on the altar still. She might not have looked exactly like that, but and partly because of the situation of who she was and how the story went, which I'll get into, we don't actually know, you know, really the day that she was born and died. And we don't know so much about her, even though she's our first woman ancestor. And this seems to be the way that things have gone. So I wanted to tell her story for those who don't know. And also we're going through this series on the Bodhisattva precepts on Wednesday nights. And I thought we could skip over the second one, come back to it, and get into the precept of not misusing sexuality or no sexual greed in relation to Mahaprajapati and her story. Because it's a story about sexuality, among other things. So Mahaprajapati, how many people have heard the story of how this came to be? How she came to. Well, then this is great. Then I'm glad I'm bringing it up. If everybody knew the story, maybe we'd skip over, because it's quite moving. And this is from the early Buddhist canon, so probably quite accurate, you know, to as far as we know, to what actually happened. It's from the Vinaya section of the canon, which is one of the older parts. So the Buddha was born to his mother Maya, Mahamaya, and she died several days after the Buddha was born, maybe from childbirth difficulties, or we don't know how she died. Buddha was raised by a foster mother who was Mahaprajapati, who was his mother's sister. So Buddha's aunt, Mahaprajapati, raised him from, like, you know, a few days after his birth. So she was like his mother. And one commentary said that actually she was like the first queen of King Suddhodana, the Buddha's father, but she couldn't conceive a child, so that maybe they had several wives in those days, I don't know, but then the king married his sister. And so in some ways it's like she got her wish to have a child came true in a way, with the Buddha, getting to raise the Buddha as her child. And we don't have so many, maybe we don't have any stories about interactions between them as he was growing up, but I'm sure she was a loving mother, and they had many wonderful times together as the Buddha was growing up. And then the Buddha, before he was the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, is of the Gotama clan. So it's Mahaprajapati. Gotami is the female form of the Gotama clan. So same family. Buddha left home when he was 29, secretly. So I think probably Mahaprajapati and the rest of his family was probably quite distraught. But then I think they came to hear stories of him and at some point knew that he was on this spiritual quest and accepted it at some point. And it seemed like they came to honor him by the time he came back to visit. So he did come back to visit like maybe several times after his enlightenment. He went back to his hometown of Kapilavastu and visited. But there's one particular visit. This was 5 years after the Buddha's great awakening. So he was 40 years old. And Buddha was staying in Kapilavastu as he wandered about India. And Mahaprajapati, so at this point, the whole family, the Buddha was getting more and more renowned as the Buddha, and the family was totally supported him at this point, according to the sutras. They were very happy that that he was helping all these beings. And a lot of the family actually had left Kapilavastu to join the Buddha's order. And Mahaprajapati herself, I think the first year when he came back to visit, Buddha gave some teachings, and Mahaprajapati realized a breakthrough into Dharma. She entered the stream of Dharma, which means that she saw through the illusion of an independent self. She glimpsed this reality. She was set free from a lot of her suffering. It wasn't the end of the path, but in this early model, it was. She entered the stream. Sometimes they call it the stream of the Eightfold Path. And so she was, we could say an enlightened one. At like the first level of enlightenment, she'd seen her true nature, and she was on the path of practice, still living at home in the palace for several years. Maybe as the Buddha came and went, we don't know how many times, but this is 5 years later the Buddha came back, and this time Mahaprajapati, we have the sense that she wanted to deepen her practice. She was on the path, but she knew it led further because she was on the path. She knew it led further. So, and she saw the great advantage of living in the Buddha's community, meditating all the time and hearing the teachings all the time. And her life was very busy, we might imagine. And she wanted to join this home leavers order of the Buddha, as many of her male family had. So she went to the Buddha. Mahaprajapati went to the Buddha and paid homage and stood at one side, always very respectful. And she said, "Lord, it would be good if women could obtain the going forth from the home life into homelessness," which is how they called entering the Buddha's order, leaving home, into the Dharma and Vinaya, the teaching and the discipline declared by the Perfect One. And the Buddha said, "Enough, Gotami. Do not ask for the going forth from home life into homelessness for women in the Dharma and discipline declared by the Perfect One, by the Tathagata. Don't ask," he said, very strong, you know. You'd think this was his foster mother, right? Don't ask. this is too much. You might think, well, isn't it a natural request? Isn't this just inevitable that that women will start asking? And again, you know, we don't know about this culture in such great detail, what was happening in the Buddha's time in India, but it looks like there were all these wandering mendicants living out in the forest, and there were probably women in other orders. I think we might have a story of that. Mostly men, though, because of the roles that were set up in that society. And and there's some commentators' speculation on you know, what, why the Buddha refused like this at first. And in fact, it's a huge topic, and we don't really know. He doesn't really say. But some people guess that, well, she was, you know, this was like palace life that the Buddha grew up in, and Mahabhajapati still lived in. And that she was used to this very comfortable life, and the Buddha's homeless life was very physically challenging. It was literally homeless. It was, they were lived out in the forest with, they could have three robes and a bowl, and just lived on what came to them day to day, no possessions, and no roof, often even. Very strict and simple life. And maybe the Buddha thought, this is too much for my poor aunt. I wouldn't want to subject her to this life that I'm living, even though I love it. We can assume the Buddha really liked the life he lived, and many others too, but that this would be too much for her in particular, maybe he thought. And also maybe things about the society at that time, that there were virtually no women doing that kind of life, and that it would be, already the Buddha was admitting people from all different castes, men from all different castes into the order, the so-called untouchables, the lowest caste, which was already a really radical thing in that time, as we understand now that a lot of the other, like the Brahmins in their religion, it was the upper class. So the Buddha joined the classes all together, and he made no discrimination amongst the castes. It was a very, you know, segregated and hierarchical society in terms of the caste system, and still is this way in India. And so to have the untouchables be hierarchically in the Buddha's order than a noble, you know, prince from a palace who also, you know, living the same life in the order. The hierarchy, the Buddha did have a hierarchy, but it was all set up on ordination date, time when you've joined the order. So, and there's stories about these, you know, wealthy people from Buddha's clan, you know, learning from and bowing to these, you know, untouchables who joined the order earlier. Very radical in his time, sociologists say. But it was all men. So, but these might be some of the reasons why the Buddha was hesitant. Now, another commentary says, I think of an old traditional commentary says that all Buddhas, there were these, you know, seven Buddhas before Buddha, Buddhas going back to ancient times, they all had women's orders. You know, they all had a nun's order and a lay women's order, as well as male monks and lay men. These four, you know, groups. And it was inevitable that Shakyamuni Buddha would also, you know, have these four groups in his order, in his Sangha. And So, and he knew this because he was the omniscient Buddha. So he knew that she would be admitted to the order and that there would be this Bhikshuni nun's order. But the reason he was hesitated like this was to test her resolve, or maybe enable her to express her resolve, which may be for the sake of us, for the sake of later generations, to see how she really felt like this was really important, and it wasn't just a random event. It was, and the story is more strong in a way because of his refusal and her persistence. So, enough, go to me, do not ask for this, for the going forth. So she asked a second and a third time and was refused. Now often the Buddha's asked three times and then he'll say okay, but he refused three times here. And so she thought to herself, the Blessed One does not allow it, and she was sad and unhappy. She paid homage to the Blessed One and departed. And then the Buddha left Kapilavastu, as he did, kept wandering, and went to Vaishali, maybe 100 miles away. So this is a long walk, but the Buddha walked day by day in the cool part of the day and would meditate and with the large Sangha, walked along these roads of ancient India. And so maybe took some days to get 100 miles to Vaishali. And but meanwhile, Mahaprajapati was not just going to just let this go. She was, she thought there was, this conversation was not finished. So she had her hair cut off and put on the Kshaya robe, the Okesa robe, as the monks did. And with a number of the Shakyan women set out for Vaishali. So, and maybe they all shaved their heads and put on the, these mendicant robes and walked down the road. Very strong statement. She's like, I'm going to do it, right? She's like, I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to just do it on my own either. I totally respect the Buddha and his way of practice, and I want to join this order, and I want to make it possible for women to. So they walked this long way, barefoot, to Vaishali, and she stood outside the porch of the hall where the Buddha was staying, and her feet were swollen, her limbs covered with dust. She was sad and unhappy, with tears on her face and sobbing. As she stood there, the Venerable Ananda saw her, and he asked, "Go to me, why are you standing outside the porch like this?" And Mahaprajapati said, "Lord Ananda, it's because the Blessed One does not allow the going forth for women in the Dharma and discipline declared by the Tathagata." And then Ananda says, "Then Gotami, wait here till I ask the Blessed One about this." So Ananda is going to intervene here. And Ananda is the attendant of the Buddha for many, many years, and the one who compiled all the sutras and said, "Thus have I heard," at the beginning of every sutra, because he heard them all. So very devoted to the Buddha, but very compassionate monk. And there's a Soto Zen temple in Japan, a women's monastery in Japan, who they don't celebrate this Mahaprajapati memorial. And as far as I know, there's no other temples in the world, actually, that celebrate Mahaprajapati memorial, except for American Zen centers. This is a new movement. Although there might be. But there's this one Soto Zen women's monastery in Japan that celebrates this event of Ananda intervening and requesting the Buddha to help for on Mahaprajapati's behalf. So it's an Ananda ceremony. Interesting, isn't it? They didn't do it for the first woman ancestor. They did it for this man who helped, and which maybe is an example of how things are in these Asian cultures, actually. But quite wonderful also that, you know, to respect Ananda for this reason. So Ananda went to the Blessed One and he told him what had happened and said, Lord, it would be good if women might obtain the going forth from the home life. And the Buddha said the same thing. Enough, Ananda. Do not ask for the going forth from the home life for women. And he asked a second and a third time and it was refused also. But Ananda's not going to give up and either. So he says, he tries some kind of like tactic. Instead of just asking, he's going to reason with the Buddha now. Very kind of gutsy as the Buddha's attendant to do this. He's a little bit like arguing with him, with reasoning. He says, he thought, the Blessed One does not allow it, but suppose I ask the Blessed One in another way. So he said, Lord, are women capable, after going forth from the home life into the Dharma and discipline declared by the Tathagata, of realizing the fruit of stream entry, or once-returner, non-returner, arhat, these different stages of enlightenment? And in fact, she already had realized stream entry by other commentaries. But are they able to realize the complete full path, as it was described at that time, the arhatship, to a worthy one? The Buddha said, they are, Ananda. They are capable. Women are capable. I'm sure he was relieved at this point. And what a great positive statement that we might wonder. There's so many men practicing through the ages. Are women really? Is it possible? Here's the Buddha in the Orthodox scriptures saying, of course. And then Ananda said, if that is so, Lord, then since Mahaprajapati Gotami has been exceedingly helpful to the Blessed One. Now he's also going to use his other reasoning, right? When as his mother's sister, she was his nurse, his foster mother, his giver of milk, she suckled the Blessed One when his own mother died. Since that is so, Lord, it would be good if women could obtain the going forth. And maybe in particular Mahaprajapati at this point. So first he goes to reasoning, well, if they can practice the same as men and realize the same, why not? And then also, come on, Blessed One. She was your foster mother. She raised you. She gave you everything. And kind of out of kindness to her. And in a way, this whole story is so interesting too, because this supreme kindness, right, is like offering her this very difficult life. I mean, she really wants it, but like, please, out of kindness, offer her this way of life where she's going to live out in the forest with three robes and one meal a day, and you know, out there in the rain with no roof and all this. Please offer her this. It's kind of a strange story in a way, but it shows something about Mahaprajapati. This is what she really wants. And of course the Buddha knows this is a beautiful life. So then the Buddha gives in, but not, you know, completely. Or he gives in on certain conditions. He says, Ananda, if Mahaprajapati Gotami accepts these 8 rules, that will count as her full admission into the order, these 8 points. And I won't go into them, but you can read them. But these 8 points are like, make it even harder for her. And they're points that all the women have to follow that the men don't. And again, in a way, this is harder, I think, for a lot of us now. These 8 points are harder than just the Buddha's hesitating. And some of them are, I think Buddha was really looking clearly at the conditions of his time and how women were vulnerable in his time. There was rape going on. There were women living out with no protection, living out in the forest, were, you know, could easily be attacked, and just like nowadays. And so he said of various of these 8 points were like that they should be in close connection with the men's monk order, but they were, it was also to put them at a lower place, that a nun of 100 years, you know, he did away with the time since ordination thing. He said a nun of 100 years still has to bow down before a male monk of one day. And of the 8 points, this is the hardest one. The others are like kind of practical and maybe beneficial for the men and the women monastics. But this one is hard to understand. And we don't maybe even need to get into speculating. And whether it was even true is another thing that commentators say. Well, maybe these things got added into the canon later. This was oral tradition, and it was a text created mostly by men. So, and maybe it was just to have an order, have a particular order, a form, and maybe arbitrary. But you'd think that they could have said, well, like the form of seniority was a form to create a form. We don't know. And I think a lot of people are troubled by this because this has lasted in this, in these orders where the full monastic nuns order is has survived, which is actually in China and Korea and Zen countries and Tibet. Oh, and actually not Tibet, actually just China really and Korea. And nowadays, it's being spread. This is, we're talking about full bhikshunis, which is the full women's ordination. There are, in Theravada countries, like Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka and Cambodia, I think that the, I'm not sure about Sri Lanka, but like Thailand and Burma, it looks like that the women's order died out many, many centuries ago. And maybe due to persecution from the men's order, just or not enough support from the men's order, the women's orders died out. And part of what's built into these highly technical rules of the order is that like it has to be established by the Buddha. So there's no other Buddha. It can't, nobody on earth now can just like start officially of the nuns' order again. But luckily, as it spread to different countries, it spread to China, and the full bhikshuni order was sustained quite widely in China, and still is going in China and Taiwan and Korea, and in Japan it was for a while. And so through these, through the Chinese nuns' order, it's been able to be reinstated in these other Theravada countries even. And Tibet, where the novice, there were novice nuns in Tibet and maybe Sri Lanka through that time, but not the full ordination. But like the Tibetan novices can now be ordained in the Chinese tradition. This is something very modern, very like in the last, through the Western Buddhist, actually, movement, and Western American nuns in the Tibetan tradition have begun this movement to kind of in the spirit of Mahabodhyapati. We want to be equal full ordination as the male monks in China and Tibet, where they have these ordinations. Now, like Japan, and therefore America in the Zen tradition, we don't have like that lineage of full ordination going back to the Buddha's time in terms of the way that they have it set up. So it's because we don't have those, all those rules about how it gets the procedures for the ceremonies are very specific and can't be altered. Has to be a certain number of people and so on. And since we don't have those strictures, it's very nice that we can, our order can flow more freely and easily. And we have the same, in Japan to some extent, and definitely in America, we've equalized out this thing of the men's and women's order. Although you still see in Japan, I mean, they're separate men's and women's orders, but they're at least close to equal standing. They would never do this thing of, I mean, somewhat in the culture, there's the thing of women feel sometimes subservient to men because men put that into the culture. So that was the Mahapajapati's ordination into the home leavers order, and many women followed. And after that, it was just open, and many, many women were ordained, and there was the fourfold Sangha. And so now, how does this relate to this third precept of not misusing sexuality, we sometimes say, we translate it as, I think is a good translation, or a good way to put it. Literally, the Chinese characters for that precept for us says something like, no sexual greed. So that's like, open to a lot of interpretation. So is misuse. You know, what does that mean? What does that mean for us? Basically, because, you know, we don't have so much time to get into this, like all the precepts, this one points to not acting from a self-centered place, not harming others out of self-centeredness. And the Bodhisattva precepts, that's always the spirit. So, this is an area where it gets its own precept because it's there's a lot of room for harm and for self-centeredness. We can see in our society it's huge. So it's great that it's included as a precept to really look at this in big ways, and we might say, well, you know, I don't misuse sexuality, but with all these precepts, look at all the small ways we do. Through body, speech, and mind. We say, Dogen's comment says, because the three wheels are pure, and various commentaries, some say the three wheels are subject, object, and activity, like the doer, the done to, and the action. So that's one possibility which fits nicely with this precept. When self and a sexual partner and the act of sexuality are pure, meaning we see the interdependence of them and the non-separation of these three. And this would apply to all precepts and all practices, have these three wheels. It's not just this one. A subject, an object, and an action. Pure means no separation, not no inherent separation between these three. They're completely interdependent. In other words, one person interacting sexually with another person is dependent on that person, and that person's dependent on that, and they're both dependent on the action that they're doing, and so on. And because they interdependently arise together, because of that, they're empty of any graspable, you know, true existence. This is basic emptiness teaching. So what does this mean in terms of the precept? It means to really look at how actually I'm creating that person, that object of sexual attraction or greed, if we're looking at the precept of no sexual greed. If I'm greedy for this person, actually I'm creating that person and I'm creating the action, you know, with my projection of essence onto them. And they're creating me. And none of us exist without each other. So, and when we really open to that dimension, the situation is much more opened up. And then if we could really open to that at a time of, say, sexual greed, it seems that the proposal is that the greed would not arise, the greed would drop away. We say, wow, I'm actually, it's almost like the whole thing is like, I don't even know what's happening here anymore. Like, what is this? And like, the greed is about thinking there's a separate object out there that I don't have and I want to get for me. Just like most of these precepts are based on this false belief in separation. And just like this problem about women being admitted to the order and being in a different, a lower status in the order, could be seen as they're the, you know, objects separate from men making the rules, something like this. Now, it's hard to talk about, you know, how the Buddha saw all this, but because there's practicalities in the conventional world at the same time. And yet, I think for us today, where Shakyamuni Buddha is long gone, this is what we have to look at, is how are we relating in terms of sexuality and gender and hierarchy and objectification and all these huge topics with practice. And I'd say all of these issues could fit into this precept of not misusing sexuality and no sexual greed. Now, one ancient commentary on Dogen's commentary on the precepts by Banjin Dotan, he says, talking about no sexual greed and purity, which he talks about the three wheels being pure like this, and purity also being meaning at its deepest level, non-attachment to the idea of purity even, that he says, even arousing the view of men and women being different gender is sexual greed. So this is like a strict version of this precept. Very strict, right? This is simply feel like, this precept's not too hard for me. I think when it gets down to this, it's like, yeah. So, and at the same time, we don't deny that that in the conventional world, there's the appearance of monastics and lay people and men and women and different categories like this. But at the deepest level, even arousing the view of men and women is sexual greed. So that's interesting to work with it on that level, I think. Also, Banjin Dotan says how to purify, in his commentary on these precepts. Another version of these three wheels is body, speech, and mind. Other commentators say three wheels in this case means body, speech, and mind. No sexual greed means like don't talk in a sexually diminishing and disrespectful way. And mind also, right? So to purify, Banjin Dodan says, to purify the body purify the body with the body, and purify speech with speech, and purify mind with mind, and purify the whole earth with the whole earth. Which is something to take up as a Zen koan, but briefly, you could just say that like the Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra says, practitioner is mindful of the body in the body. Mindful of the mind in the mind, we could say, and speech in the speech. Means like not some idea of the body, but actually like being completely the awareness of the body as the body, not separating, like here's my awareness of the body, but body in the body or as the body, you could even say. So we purify the body with the body means just being this body and speech and mind. And this is the way to practice not misusing sexuality with the body is to just let the body we have be the body we have, be another way to put it. And let others' bodies be their bodies. And so not, and not wishing for something else than this moment. And that one, you know, that's the Four Noble Truths, and that's all the precepts are fulfilled, not wishing for something other than what's happening. So for someone in a sexual relationship, it could be like in the midst of sexual activity with great love and care, there's not wishing to not be in that situation, you know, if one's in that situation. So, and just like all our activity, when we're, whatever activity we're in, where there's non-separation from the activity. So, I'll end with a poem by Mahaprajapati. The poems of the, there's a whole collection of the poems or verses by the elder nuns, the Therigatha. And I thought this was a wonderful poem praising the Buddha. After, by the way, Mahaprajapati, after she entered the order, she did go on to realize full arhatship, the complete enlightenment in her path of practice, the end of all greed, hate, and delusion, the cessation of all suffering, no more becoming, no more birth, the end of samsara. She went to the end of the path. And it's nice, I thought too, because it mentions the Eightfold Path, which we're studying, which she followed along with all these disciples of Buddha. She says, "Awakened, hero, homage to you, highest of all beings, you who've released me and many other people from suffering. I've comprehended all suffering and discontent, dried up craving, the cause, developed the Eightfold Path, and touched cessation. Before, I was mother, son, father, brother, grandmother, through many lives. Not knowing things as they were, I wandered on without respite. But now that I've seen the Blessed One, this is my last body heap. Birth and wandering on of samsara are totally ended. There is now no further becoming." Just like the Buddha said in the first sutra. "I see the disciples gathered, their persistence aroused, resolute, constant, in strong exertion. This is the worship of the Buddhas." Wonderful. That This is the worship of the Buddhas, is the disciples gathered with persistence, resolute, constant. Truly, for the benefit of the many, did Maya give birth to Gotama, thrusting away the mass of pain of those mired in illness and death. If anybody has just a question or two before we close, we can also talk in the house.
It makes me think of the stories I've heard about Suzuki and his own wrestling with gender. And that, you know, when he started out in San Francisco, the men and women were sitting on different sides of the Zendo. And I guess it was quite a lot of thought was put into whether Sahara was going to be co-educational, whether it was going to be a men's monastery.
I heard someone was just telling me that. I hadn't remembered that story. Something like that Suzuki Roshi was kind of leaning towards an all-men's monastery, and it was Baker Roshi who said, if there's not men and women here together, there's no Tassahara. So he kind of intervened like Ananda as Suzuki Roshi's assistant. And he was one of the ones who had some of the most trouble because of that very fact. So, yeah.
And of course, that was just in the 60s.
Yeah.
And, in the neighborhood next door to Zen Center, men and women were fornicating in the streets.
Yes, right.
At the time that he was having them sit on different sides of the it's an interesting thing to think about.
And I think that Zen Center and American Zen have, since Suzuki Roshi's time, have been looking at this issue deeply and ongoingly, and things have really evolved in both directions. In the sense of men and women really practicing together. We've had several women abbots at San Francisco Zen Center, as well as Santa Cruz, and completely equal hierarchically, and they're the leaders of the community often, and also all practicing together more and more, really looking at the issues of how sexuality can be misused also, and really getting more and more clear about in our new form of where we're not just kind of segregating, and how is this going to work, and how does it work, and how do we practice with these precepts like this. And also, this is, it's not just men and women, but also within homosexuality, it's like, how are we going to practice together as groups? And let's not even make the distinctions of like breaking it down into men and women like this, but in a larger picture, how is this all going to play out?
It seems pretty clear that it's not the physical proximity of women and men together, or men and men together, or women and women together, that gives rise to sexual greed.
And, exactly.
What you discussed tonight, it seems to me that the where the problem, or maybe the disjointedness begins to occur, is in the objectifying of another.
Exactly, yeah.
And in a way, in the West, we've been able to kind of wade our way through the gender proximity to believe, demonstrating that that's not the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I also like to believe now for future generations that that will ripple.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's, it makes it, it's more conducive to practicing well to have everybody practicing together and to practice with our sexuality up close with everybody and to not segregate. I think, I mean, people could argue both sides of this, but just because it's like it breaks down the distinction and objectification. We're all just people practicing together, you know. And if you make it different sides of the room, they're like, oh, then that's that side and that's that side, and it kind of heightens the issue. Or if people are practicing in a monastery, if it's all men and they never see any other women, and then, you know, they go into town one day and they're just like shocked and there's women, they don't know how to deal with it or whatever. It's like, I think this is like, we practice with it and it's just like the normal thing. It's like the world. And seems much more conducive to actually practicing with such a precept.
In the same way, it seems to me that it's not, sexuality might be one facet of it, and sexual expression or feelings might be one facet of it. But it's also about the assumptions we might make about someone else's worldview,
mm-hmm.
that they've grown into through their gender. So it has worldview, and it has authority, and it has so many...
What has that?
Any aspect of gender, even mm-hmm. the rest that we mm-hmm. look at, has, it seems to me, a flavor of some authority.
Yeah.
So sexuality or the sexual feelings that might arise are just one little facet
mm-hmm.
of this lovely way that we've been able to practice together.
Yeah. And it's a huge topic, actually, you know. And I think another implication of this whole discussion, too, is how... in the forms of practice we have here is largely inherited from male tradition. And so sometimes it has that kind of flavor. And we've been talking about some of the forms recently, and do they have too yang a flavor, for example, meaning like masculine. And I think when we say masculine and feminine in this kind of case, it doesn't necessarily refer to men and women, but those qualities of either men or women. But they're different qualities, the masculine and the feminine. And some of our forms, many of them, I think, have a masculine or yang kind of feeling. And yet there's something very feminine at the same time. And I wanted to mention, please let me just bring up this one last image, because I wanted to tie this in somehow. Maybe this would be a whole other talk. But there's in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which is Dung Shan, one of our Soto Zen ancestors, founder of Soto Zen in China, wrote this text, and it's based somewhat around the I Ching, the most ancient book in the world, maybe Book of Changes. And the I Ching is made up of yang and yin lines, as people may probably know the I Ching, is that right? The solid and the dashed line. And solid is yang and dashed is yin line. This is like before language even began in the world, there was this delineating these two types of energy in the world or something. And then these lines can be made into these trigrams, combinations of three lines, and there's eight trigrams that make up 64 hexagrams in this mathematical system of the I Ching. And it was a very important book in China. So, and Dung Shan used these ideas of this book in the, to kind of as a basis maybe for the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and it's built on this trigram, three lines that are yang, yin, yang. Solid dash solid is the trigram. I think it's fire trigram. And we say the double split hexagram, in a, maybe in our translation, if people know this text, is this, he's talking about these permutations of these movement, of these changes through these lines of yin and yang. And so we could say that this is like in the I Ching, manifest in Soto Zen, manifest as this trigram of two solid lines surrounding a split line. It's a Soto Zen trigram. And so there's some, we could say, I mean, this might have been my teacher speculating on this, but being creative as Dongshan did with these I Ching things, but that it's Soto Zen, our style of practice, is like, has a feminine interior, a feminine heart surrounded by masculine outer form. I thought that was a beautiful idea, whether, you know, he just made that up or not. And this trigram, that's what it's the, you know, it's the feminine surrounded by the masculine. And I feel that's really true more and more just in our practice, that our heart of zazen, of just sitting, is completely receptive, feminine. It's the receptive samadhi. It's the self receiving its function. It's a non-doing. It's just being with the world, completely feeling all it is, we could say feminine qualities. Not necessarily, you know, in men and women. And then the outer form is very, like, specific. Like, you do this and you don't do that. And it's very upright and doing kind of oriented and particular and detailed and sometimes has a very masculine feeling. And that outer form is surrounding this very receptive, very gentle, loving heart. I think it's a beautiful image, and we could say that is carried out in this whole interaction between Shakyamuni Buddha and Mahaprajapati and all the Buddhas and ancestors since then, constantly shifting and changing, but always these elements, always trying to balance. Keep them balanced. We dedicate the merit of tonight's talk to Acharya Mahaprajapati Gotami and all women practitioners throughout space and time. Beings are numberless. I vowed to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vowed to end them.